Hello, Weldon. I think we're now all here. Let me just say a word about Estella Weldon, who was one of the women I most hugely admire in this entire field of psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. She's not only a fine writer and gave us the book of Madonnas, a mother's Madonnas and whores, I'm going to forget the time, it's that time of day. But she created the international meeting ground, the International Association for Forensic Psychiatry.
Psychotherapy,
which is incredibly important and has done, I think, some of the most interesting and novel thinking about what she herself calls malignant bonds, those bonds that I try to put to one side, at least for a few moments, in All About Love, although, of course, they're the shadow side of love and inform all our ways very deeply. Now, Estella is going to give us a paper, and then we're going to have time to question her and also perhaps question all our other speakers in a final plenary session, a brief plenary session. So, sorry, while you take your seats, I'm just babbling on here as we wait for Estella. Yes? Is everyone seated? Has everyone got a place to go to? Just a few more coming. So, Estella, there's Cupid behind you. Are you going to give us Cupid?
Hey, this is not me. Sorry. That is not me at all.
Well, Cupid with a grimace. Cupid with a grimace
now,
in the face.
There you have. Now,
okay, Estella Weldon.
Okay, thank you so much for inviting me here for the museum. And Lisa, I cannot find where I put my abstract, but I talked something about the first love and the roots of the first love, and the first love about that between mother and baby that is so perfect, the union, when the union is perfect, that's the other problem, that when it's perfect, it can never be repeated because the mother's breast are filled up with milk when the baby is beginning to wake up with hunger, and this union of, you know, sort of physicality, intimacy, emotion, everything is there. So if I'm going to look for that again in life, forget it. Perhaps that's what Don Juan had in mind, man. You know, that he could never find it.
Yeah,
I don't know. So, but also when the things they go bad, they really go very, very, very bad. And we do, as forensic psychotherapists, we are dealing with the people who started a very, very bad started life. I hesitate to start because, in a way, it is sort of quite a horror case that I have in my hands here, and but also demonstrates in such a way, it demonstrates the horrors of the beginning of life. It demonstrates, I hope, that a bit of something good for a while, could allow us to do something with these people at some point later on, to restart, or to have a new start in life. And we have to feel confident, and we have to feel optimistic about the fact that sometimes we could have a good outcome out of people who have had the most horrid and horrific traumatic events in their lives. So it is a sort of a horror case, but also it's a message conveying optimism and things can work, only if we manage to do them in a way in which we feel we're being honest with ourselves too. Not just to be a do-gooder. Do-gooders don't do very well with this sort of patients. So we have to be in the profession in order, perhaps to be hated too at different times, and to be not liked or disliked or hated. This is a woman, I call the case, I am determined to be a good enough mother, even if it kills them. Mrs. S. has attempted to kill her own 3 children and herself on at least 3 occasions. She is convinced that they are harmed from birth because she had passed on them the genes from their Nazi grandfather, and that they are also psychologically damaged as a result of her being a bad mother when she felt depressed and unable to care for them. She does not experience regret about these actions. On the opposite, she experiences a great deal of shame at not having succeeded. She's adamant in saying that she would prefer them dead rather than endure the suffering she has gone through. She has never envisaged including her husband in these killings. She has been previously treated as an inpatient at the medium secure unit for a period of around 10 years, where she was treated with medication and many and long series of electroshock therapy. Mrs. S is the product of a violent rape in a country occupied by the Nazis. She was born in 1942. Father unknown, first thought to be a German Nazi, but later transpired he actually was an informed citizen from the same country. In her own words, my birth was my family's shame. When born, I should have been thrown out of the window. Sadly, no one bothered. Now, since I am myself now in the last few years a grandmother, I also like to think in terms of our grandmothers offering something also to the children and being there available. She was brought up by grandmother's home, in all female household, and was constantly subjected to humiliation and denigration by the mother and the aunt. Members of the family constantly used to address her, "You Nazi shit." Now, the only really good relationship she had was with her grandmother, but at the age of 8, her grandmother died. This has been her only, as I said, one and good relationship. Soon after the marriage, the mother married a violent alcoholic man who immediately began to abuse the little girl. Not only he physically and sexually abused her, but also got his male friends to join in her sexual abuse. At the age of 14, she gets pregnant, not being completely aware of this fact, although remembers vividly that she was in the bathroom when the baby came out. Her stepfather, who assumedly was the new baby's father, was with her, preventing anyone coming near there. Now, you prepare yourself because a horrific scene developed. When he saw the newborn baby, he took it away from her. He first cut off one of the baby's hands, wrapped him in a newspaper, put petrol all over, and burned it. Then he forced to have the young mother also as a witness of all this. Soon after, she left home and married an Englishman, moving to England, where they had 3 children. To start with, she managed the household and the care of her children in an adequate manner. This attempt could be interpreted as being forced to give up her mother. However, and resolve the grief, eventually caught up with her following her mother's death, when she attempted for the first time to kill her children and herself. This attempt would be interpreted as her being forced to give up her mother as a bad object from infancy and to take it into herself to become the bad mother. A similar attempt took place 10 years later following her hysterectomy. She began to be chronically depressed, being treated with antidepressants. She refused to talk and didn't get out of bed for a period of almost 4 years, and she got another series of electroshock. 10 years later, in 1983, she had some gynecological repairs. She became uncommunicative, refused to eat or drink, and once more she attempted to poison her children, offering them tea laced with her husband's prescribed tablets. By then, the children were 27, 24, and 22. And after that, she took an overdose. She was detained under Section 3 of the Mental Health Act and was transferred to this secure unit. She again had electroshock treatment, and somehow the depression seemed to lift. But she often became violent breaking windows and objects in the wall and throwing objects at members of the staff. On one occasion, she destroyed all her previous medical reports. Rather clever, that. And she also remained intermittently suicidal. After 10 years as an inpatient there, she was referred to the Portman Clinic. With need to be assessment about, you know, herself and the children, and the children were grown up. We decided to offer her a series of diagnostic consultations in order to provide a sense of space to explore the relationship in development created from our different meetings. She started weekly psychotherapy with me for a 7-year period when I was due to retire from National Health Service. She began to talk about the first attempt to kill her children. Memories and flashbacks began to assault and torture her mercilessly. The killing of her first baby was a baby boy whom she secretly called Robert when she was merely a 14-year-old girl. She still remains consciously the main focus of all her concerns and preoccupations. This trauma is responsible for her survivor's guilt. She feels not allowed to survive him, and her 3 live children are to face the same fate. After all, in her mental representations, they are not only born of her body, but they are parts, extension of her body and mind. As she gets better, this nightmarish imagery revisits her more ferociously than ever, with increasing suicidal ideation and homicidal feelings being left behind. All her attempts to kill her children were executed in the same way, as a mother in the feeding role. She did it through poisoned food. I shall give a very sort of brief account of her therapy with me, which lasted 7 years. For the first year, she was being brought by an ambulance with 2 nurses in an ambulance. All the medium secure unit, she was 2 hours away, so it's 2 hours coming and 2 hours going back. Then positive changes began to take place during the therapy, so then she was allowed to visit family for weekends, and the visits increased. As a matter of fact, after 3 years of being in treatment, she was released from the medium secure unit and began to live at home with her husband. Since then, she began to come to her sessions on her own and out of her own volition using public transport. Quite a great achievement, really. All her period of therapy, she brought much written material, including her own poems and dreams. Very, very creative woman. In this sense, she shows that despite having psychologically damaged, she's sensitive and creative. During the course of therapy, she became a grandmother as her daughter had a baby girl. She kept a consistent contact with her children and sees her granddaughter regularly, with whom she keeps a close relationship. Now, there are many reasons for which I chose this woman to present her today. I mean, not only just that she was never able, not only she was unable to experience a first love relationship, but she experienced degradation, rejection, dismissal, I mean, so unwelcome. It's just absolutely. But also that somebody who, we can learn something from somebody who has experienced so much violence, deeply enmeshed in with sexuality and procreation in her life from the moment of conception onwards. I also believe, following the previous presentation, I'm sorry I couldn't come this morning, I was elsewhere, but so I'm not sure what has been talked, but previous presentation by Anna, I believe that future violence are different for both genders. Body, sexuality and violence are inevitably intertwined with physical, biological and anatomical attributes which are in the making of violent acts, with a plethora of symbolisms and effects, which at times are shared by men and women, but at other times are clearly distinct. It is those distinctive characteristics I would like to address. In so doing, I would refer to women generally, and specifically to my women patients. Our own female attributes in relation to fecundity, our capacity to get pregnant and become mothers, is pivotal to the comprehension of violence in general. After all, we are the ones who carry the babies in our own bodies and attend to the ministrations of their bodies. We have invested so much in our mothering enterprises that we want to get the best results. Still, at times, we feel suddenly assaulted from within with the realization that we may not be able or feel equipped to deal with all mothering requirements. Our own emotional legacy, despite our best intentions, can easily interfere in our carrying out this in a consistent, caring way. And it is then that we are not able to stop violence taking place. Although there are numerically speaking much fewer women involved in crimes of violence, it is important to remember that there is much more violence at home than in the streets. Domestic violence includes not only women being the victims, but also at times they may become the abusers of their husbands or partners. But let's not forget that it is children who are most vulnerable members of the family, and they are the recipients of much violence from both their mothers and fathers, and also as witnesses of parental discord acted out in violent fighting. At times, women get involved in acts of violence which are very different from men's. For example, often it is hidden away, takes place in the domestic sphere, and it's born out of women's frustration. It is then aimed at those who are the dearest and closest and the most vulnerable ones, our own children. It is basic to understand these violent processes as part of a three-generational approach in which a cycle of violence and abuse has been created at least two generations back. This understanding would preempt facile moral judgments and effective prevention plans could be implemented. Some thoughts about understanding, Mrs. S. In the light of psychodynamic theories, the psychological understanding of these women's homicidal and suicidal attempts is consistently comprehensible. I am reminded of one of my early mentors, Carl Menninger, where he says that all cases of violence have meaning and represent an effort to avoid something worse. Quote, the murder is often committed in order to preserve the individual's sanity, end of quote. It's impossible to present all the intricacies and complexities of this case, so I just, perhaps I will just focus myself on murders and suicidal actions which are consistently related to the to do with maternity and associated losses, as you have seen before about her case. Her grandmother's death may have left her not only completely desolated, but also unable to experience any grief, especially so since she had been the fixed target for constant humiliation. On the opposite, the appalling succession of sexual abuse incidents inflicted on her by her stepfather and his friends following her grandmother's death may have become a manic defense replacing the forbidden grief. She may have experienced her becoming the sexual object for all these men as an identification with her mother at the time of her mother's rape. This sexual abuse culminated in her giving birth to a baby boy at the age of 14, who was then murdered by her stepfather. In her own mind, she becomes the reenactment of her own birth when she sees herself as a hated baby, object of savagery and barbaric behavior, as opposed to her death, to her, the baby dies, but she continues to be alive. This woman's predicament shows that through her homicidal attempts, she may be trying to protect her own children. She may have felt so overwhelmed by the shame of her own birth that she could only preserve herself as a psychological entity by sacrificing her own body and those of others created within her own body. One could easily speculate in Jim Gilligan's world that her homicidal and suicidal attempts were based on replacing shame with pride. Are these attempts motivated by survivor's guilt, or are they altruistic in nature? After all, what she had in mind was to save her children from the life she herself had. She wanted her children to die just as she wanted to be killed when she was born. She resents and repudiates her mother for not having done this, since she experiences herself to be a bad object, the outcome of a brutal rape by the most despised political public enemy. There are paradoxically other challenges to the understanding of this patient. For example, how this woman has been able to mother three children in their early infancy without any gross misbehavior. One could speculate that her one good relationship to her grandmother until the age of 8 facilitated some healthy identification with her during that period that was responsible for her mothering her babies without any serious complications. This good enough experience may be responsible for accepting the offered therapy, experiencing me as the enactment of a grandmother, which she effectively used later on in becoming herself a grandmother of a little girl. This capacity for identification was clearly shown during one session a year after therapy started, when she wrote a written statement saying, "I own my life and only mine. And so I shall appreciate my person, and so I shall make proper use of myself." This was quite an unusual piece of writing. All her weekly delivery of written messages are filled with torture, terror, and emotional pain, which at times I did find very difficult and painful to take it in. I was taken by surprise. Was she experiencing an increased sense of self-esteem? No, actually, as she explained, this had nothing to do with her. It was a picture of me. On reflection, some degree of identification with her experience of me on accepting and self-assertive grandmother was on operation. We went through different phases and tried to. First phase, fear of being suddenly dropped out or rejected and needs to be reassured. At first, she was bewildered at having been accepted for therapy, and I was constantly challenged since she assumed that very soon I would fed up and give her up. The session before Christmas, she came with a letter saying, "Dr. Weldon, are you angry with me? Everybody else is. Are you sure I see you after the new year? You have not changed your mind. I am afraid you only come to hate and despise me, most of the people I have come across." This was a quote. Obstinate quest for being reassured she could not be rejected. "Doctor, I am a plasticine in your hands. You can mend me this way, that way, and when fed up, sling me in a bin, and I am afraid and I am tearful. I have to finish what time. I'm a bit worried about that.
4:15, 4:30.
Okay. So, at the end of the session, she used to refuse to leave. And she used to get very angry when I was silent. "Why are you not prepared to answer my questions? I answer your question. I don't know how to deal with your persistent, perturbing silence." Punishment, again and again. Sometimes she would bring all sorts of drinks, and sometimes she would offer them to me. You know, it goes over to drinking at least. Certainly not. And I would make the interpretations too. But also, she was suffering from diabetes, and so she was checking me because a lot of them, they were very sugary things, where I was on the alert to take care of her. Then she began to get second phase, open transferential aggression against her fear of dependency. So now she began to experience an enormous reaction of anger at being in an active way. I think that had to do with her having an incipient sense of trust on me. That's why she allowed herself to be angry. She first used to get irritated and later on became quite explosive, throwing things like pens and paper clips at me. At times, her hostility was hidden in the veneer of concern. "I don't want to see you when you're not feeling well. It's not good for you, not me. You were not well last week, and I look at my eyes, dull yet ablaze with irritation." After getting to know her daughter's pregnancy, she became more agitated. She told me if she could only openly talk about her own experience and her awful feelings about her daughter's pregnancy, that would make me feel revolted. And ultimately, I would not have no option but to reject her. So as my interpretation and understanding of the negative transference became clear, she began to see me as very acutely, she very acutely observed. Therapist is the rapist, if you got the word, yeah. I was experienced to be too penetrated for her own good. Intense hated and envious feelings were explored in the sessions. She could hardly tolerate my interpretations, and many times she attempted to leave the sessions feeling furious with me. This was immediately superseded by guilt, with a very invasive quality which made me a maternal offer to take care of me. And saying this horrid thing, I'm sorry, Hassan Yu, next time you come with me and I take care of you, can you can rest all day, she would say that to me. Sleep all day, drink a lot, water, then sponge you down with lukewarm water, give you paracetamol every 4 hours until you are well. Then you go and convalesce on a cruise trip for 8 weeks. After that, you will be more than glad to resume work with me and you will be fit, yes? So, then she began to look forward to her grandchild's birth, and this was marked by a period of contentment. This was very strange because her own appearance began to completely change. Whereas at the beginning she was very overweight, almost obese, and she used to walk very slowly in a rather robot-like manner. She was like a whale, and then I saw she was a bit like a dolphin. She began to lose weight, and then also her whole appearance improved. Her gait became lighter, and she much better groomed than before. And I saw that as a sort of myself, as a mother of a proud mother of an adolescent rebellious child, you know, getting nicer. And after the granddaughter was born, she began to bring me pictures of herself and the granddaughter together. She began to be much more placid, and a sort of process of double identification began to take place with herself being granddaughter and grandmother in the past, in the here and now. There was a genuine quality of taking care of the little girl and appreciating tremendously their bonding. The third phase, pains of growing up. She told me the sense of reality regarding her granddaughter's physical and emotional growth, in that she is already aware. Very soon the baby will walk away from her in search of other, more attractive sex in life. So obviously that was true too. So in listening to her, it seemed to me to be an appropriate time to make an interpretation which included the fact that a similar time would come for us both. I felt that we had to start the preparation for a termination of the therapy due to my impending retirement in 2 years' time. Since in her mind she had the belief that there would be a lifeline for her to be with her until she dies. On getting to know the inability of the ending of therapy with me, she became listless, agitated, and angry. She told me she dreaded her future life and that in a concrete way my retirement might make her own retirement from life. She wanted to know if I am going to put her right before I go, or otherwise, what or who I am going to offer to her. She feels that any improvement on her part will fade away in no time. This I felt sometimes rather pressurized. Well, she brought a dream, which I said I wanted to read and to tell you the different interpretations, because I said may be rather important. The manifest content of the dream is related to the horrifying scene with the first baby, when the baby was murdered, and then he becoming a grandmother, all obviously entrenched in the transference. In the dream, she's with a baby girl, a toddler, in a train station, waiting for a train. Actually, that was when I came back from holidays, and she used to come by train to the station. She saw herself in hospital and the baby was lying on top of a bed with a lot of pus coming out of its nose and the chest was rather bluish. With her hands she began to caress the baby's chest because she knew that the baby was dying. She said that instead of doing circular motions, she was doing a sort of vertical motion, which she later thought it was a fatal thing to do and she was in despair about it. But what upset her most was not so much the realization that the baby was dying, but that the baby girl was holding her hand, the mother's hand, the grandmother's hand, and holding, and despite that it was very small, the baby's hand, it covered completely her own hand. This was very scary because she did not know what to expect from this baby or what the baby was expecting from her, although it was certain that the baby was dying. There were many options to choose for interpretations to be made about this dream with such rich material, and it would be enlightening to see what your comments could be about this. I decided to take it in a transferential way. Who was the carer and who was the child? And indeed, who was rescuing who? It seems that we are together without any other person in sight for help. I am not taking proper care of her. As a matter of fact, I am neglecting her, and what is my hand doing to make her worse, to even cause her death? Suddenly I had the free association she had some time ago, some years ago, about the baby's hand and a poem about being, I was angry, she said, and are you angry with me? Are you angry with me? Tell me. And so I want to understand what's what. In remembering this thing that happened the year before, I decided to offer an interpretation which would encompass most elements in the transference, focusing on the hand. Is this a health, her firstborn hacked hand, or is the caring, comforting hand which he needs, or is it the sexualized, masturbating hand which takes her away from any mourning process? Was this my own hand, in that the vertical motions represented my penetrating interpretations, at times almost like cutting her? Were the circular motions the desire to resuscitate her with more benign interpretations, as if she was telling me, I need to remain a bit mad in order to survive. I cannot take all this in. It is too much, and it will make me die. I noticed that she looked much more content, and did remark on the fact that she was not so agitated, and that she was much more relaxed, which she was able to accept. She was ready to depart promptly at the end of this session. She also said that this time it had been all right. She could see that I was not angry with her, and then she left. It becomes more and more clear the important role the body plays in people who have suffered severe traumas. My patient talked extensively about her body, her husband's body, my body, but much more about her little boy's haggard hand. I believe that in my patient, the little hand has become, throughout the course of the therapy, a bodily feature between dream and hallucination, which has intermittently but consistently appear during the sessions. The fourth phase, taking contact with reality. She began to experience a constant preoccupation about her marriage, her awareness of her husband's complete detachment from her and everybody else, although he has seen the good man in the family. He very much resents her improvement and as a result of her having asserted her own voice, feelings and ideas. This is the first time the conditions have been created for her to use and develop her own mind, or for her even to have a mind at all. She wants in a desperate way for her family to enter family therapy. This was not supported by the social services. It seems that her position in life will remain that of a foreign body, and her fate is to be the dysfunctional member of an otherwise ordinary family. In a way, also became a sign of mental sanity in her being able to be in touch with the mental territory and not to regress to the automaton state, the robot state, which she did go through after the second homicide-suicide attempt, when she remained in hospital completely uncommunicative and isolated, and with electroshock. In testing, it was reminded of Ferenczi's quote, "The abused child changes into a mechanical, obedient automaton." And later on, Schenkel says, but the automaton has murdered inside. Van der Kolk poignantly describes the phenomena that appear in these patients in relation to the body, which fits my patient's deep shifts of moods when he says, trapped between feelings, too much and too little. By this assertion, he means that these patients appeal to two different modes of behavior. In facing distress and frustration, they react either with excessive anger and impulsivity, or they become depersonalized, spaced out, or numb. The latter refers to the state I have described earlier on in my patient as obedient automaton. Not all traumatic events can be integrated into experience. There's a limit as to how much better she can take in, as represented in her dream. The message is, I cannot give this moribund baby the kiss of life. Some experiences will remain untransformed in her mind. This has also made me think and discuss with colleagues about modifications in psychotherapeutic techniques with working with patients who have suffered from severe or too early traumas in which symbolic thought is often absent. How much and for how long a convention with these patients to make interpretations that, although accurate, may lose all therapeutic value because they may experience them as penetrating and violating, and as such rendering them unable to take them in, digest and process them. Indeed, how much is one cajoled or forced in the transference process to become a sort of perpetrator? I believe that one should not hide away from interpreting the negative transference, especially in the initial phase, when they badly need the recognition and acknowledgement of their negative experiences. On the other hand, the therapist should be on the alert on how much patients can take in order to remain the therapist and not to become the rapist. The process of identification with the aggressor that dominates the lives of people who have been abused becomes rather entangled here. The two men, who appear more ostensibly and significantly in her early life, are extremely violent and sadistic, and both have been sexually attached to her own mother. Her biological father is responsible for her generally hated and repudiated birth. Her stepfather is responsible for her further denigration, her sexual abuse, and later becomes the killer of her first child. Are both amalgamated into one? Violence, sexuality, and sadism are all ingredients mixed up in her psychological makeup. Her choice of partner, which appears superficially to be an unusual one in that he can offer stability and support, but simultaneously he cannot stay her being able to communicate her own feelings, then he becomes a sadistic one. It is interesting to note that she has never been charged and that her husband has elected to remain an apparently supportive and loyal family man, but who has consistently refused to take anything seriously. Even her suicidal and homicidal attempts have gone almost unnoticed. Her husband in the family is the martyr, the one who stands for her and takes always her responsibility. So this becomes almost unbearable when she gets better, and then it's unbearable for him to remain as a sort of a supportive part of the member of the family, giving her much more support, but she remains in a sort of isolated way. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you so much for an enthralling and also, I think, very difficult to process paper, because there's just so much pain there. And I just want to say one thing. I forgot to mention Estella's most wonderful recent book, Playing with Dynamite, which I think there are copies of here, and if not, certainly at the Freud Museum. And it's, it contains some of the case histories as well as the trajectory of her own life. And I think I want to begin by asking Estella one question which I've always worried about, which is this, Estella. What is it in you that allows you to deal and to process and to work with these extreme patients and indeed extreme situations?
I must say, I don't really know. But I know, as I said before, I know that I have in my life more traumas than a lot of my patients, but I know how to deal with the problems. And the patients sometimes, the difference is the patients, they are not able to deal with problems, and we have to help them, and we have to have compassion. We don't have to feel a degree of superiority because we can deal with, you know, and they cannot. But, saying that,
I think you once said something about being angry when you needed to.
Oh, well, yes. No, but this has to do with the fact that first of all, I always tell people, listen, don't become therapists if you want people to love you or to like you, because, you know, this is ridiculous. I mean, people come to you because they have been victims of a lot of, you know, anger, rejection. People are never able to express that openly because they were scared of being left, of being abandoned, of being rejected. So they have to come to us and to express all that to us. And that's when I said, this woman, I had to cut a lot of her poems about anger. And when Super BC comes to me and says, you know, my patient, oh, that's great, you know, the patient is showing that he's trusting you with it, your degree to contain the anger. What happened with this woman that she has to be brought by nurses, and I mean, every week to there and cost a lot of fortune. After she can come on her own. That in itself, let's say, It is a remarkable improvement. She wants to get better. She doesn't want to get more and more bloody electroshock therapy. But obviously, every time, look, it's very clever to destroy her own notes when she has been so awful in the place. So she destroys her own notes. Nobody has got any evidence about her bad behavior before. I thought it was rather clever to do that. You see, I mean, I thought, well, for you, good for you, man. If they're treating you so bad as to give you all the electroshock, go on and bake everything on there. You know. So I will be very much into that, identifying with that part, because I have always been a very rebellious child. I'm very, very rebellious. And when my father said, you know, to my daughter, show some disrespect. So I said, I don't want any bloody respect. I don't want any respect. I want her to treat me this way. And so the girl, I was so happy because she said, her mother was 40-something, her father was 30, and I was 26. So I said, well, that we are here, we are. And everybody was very angry, but it's because I chose to be younger. That's all. It's something, I just don't know, it's something about with integrating with social injustice. I feel very strongly about social injustice. I feel very angry, and I'm very angry on those who are victims of this. And when you see these people, how can you be in possession of a judgmental mind with somebody because has tried, and actually all the attempts to kill her children, they were rather futile, you know. Well, the first time perhaps, but certainly, I was not going to drink she brought me either, by the way, you know. I'm not that naive, you know. I couldn't drink. I mean, in order to show that I really trust you, I would drink it. No way. I mean, I would say, you know, you may be feeling like a bit like killing me too at times, you know.
So, impairments of first love, what goes on in a difficult kind of, I mean, I don't know if this is transferred or not, but a holding situation with these abused and abusive patients. Questions, comments?
Perhaps the two of you would like to come in on this and actually think about the subject of first love and its abuses.
That's
all right, I'm very happy to stand. You can.
No, I want Anna to sit on the same level, otherwise she looks like.
Yeah. No, I don't want me to.
Okay, now.
Don't fall off, Anna. Safe.
Yes, but don't move.
bonding.
I just wanted to get some responses, perhaps first of all to Estella's paper, and then move along to a kind of summary, if we can.
I have more of a question. Rather, do you think that are there many cases that, like the one you talk about, that they continue to be treated just with electroshock? And
that just was my. Just or they don't get to your consulting room, or they don't get to receive what you offer.
It's an interesting question because although electroshock therapy is rarely used by now, still though, it may be very much a sign of punishment to those acts that we believe that they are absolutely incomprehensible and they are so awful that it's a way to punish. Yeah.
I think these patients challenge the limitations of our understanding and face us with the uncertainty of our professional role. I think everybody, like I was trying to describe in my paper about the mechanotransmers, particularly psychiatrists, who are bombarded by cases in ward rants every day. I don't know how they cope with it. But sometimes one wants to evacuate something back into these patients because they challenge us with our limitations, you know, and we hate them for it at some point.
Well, they are anxious more than they are just
challenged. Okay, but yes, anxious.
Is there not also a sense in which certain patients want the punishment that shock can give, at least sometimes?
Well, certainly a lot of people prefer to go to prison because they know at least they know how long they're going to be there for, as opposed to therapy. And they won't be suffering, you know, examining all these dark areas in their lives. I think that they all have a terrible fear of the black hole rather they are of depression that is inside them. But I mean, anything is preferable to that, even electroshock, really, in a way.
Also, the better the devil you know than the one you don't know. So if you're brought up in a cruel environment, cool treatment provides you with something you're familiar with. You know? The patients I was talking about were terrified of love, actually. Yeah, that can really hurt you, as we've probably all experienced at times, in our first loves.
More work in therapy than having something done to you.
Yes.
Please.
I was just really struck by the point in the story when she tries to kill her own children, thinking of Medea, but also thinking of, you know, our assumption that to kill your own is wrong and evil, when sometimes, I mean, I think in your story you're suggesting that in fact it was an act of love, that desire to kill the child, so that the pain would not be reproduced. And I think that's a really interesting and recurring theme that we find in a lot of cases, actually. A lot of stories historically where the mother has wanted to put the child out of misery, or where someone has wanted to put someone out of misery, whether it's a child or... I just sort of wondered
if
you thought about
that. Yeah, thank you very much. What is very interesting about this is that she has to believe, and that is the work of the therapy too, you see, that's a very important element that has been left out, that she has to believe in her own capacity to have healthy children. You see, that is due to her too. She thinks that she's a bad mother. For whatever I know, the children were absolutely very well, very good, very well behaved. The daughter was married, she had a profession, she had a teacher, I mean, I saw the husband, and I must say she was taking care of him, and he was quite inadequate in a way. But the children, I mean, I had to work with her also about that fact that she had been able to produce healthy children, and that's important.
But I think that this altruistic side of murder or attempted murder is very interesting. There's an early 20th century. Greek novel called The Murderess, where a grandmother goes around killing the children in the village out of saying, well, you know, they're happy now, but they'll starve for the rest of their lives. It's not worth going on. And she, one by one, she gets rid of the children. And there is this kind of motif going through things that you know, sometimes murder is a form of justice, a rage.
But it's also a sort of, isn't that a sort of...
Not that I'm recommending.
Sort of a normal. You feel extremely happy. You are in the absolute wonderful thing of in love, and then you want to die because you are afraid that this will go.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think you were earlier theme of time. So, sorry.
It's okay. It's fine. I just wanted to to stretch.
Put it close to you.
Oh, is that better?
Yeah.
I wanted to stretch Estelle a little bit here. Something I said to her at the beginning of the. Just before the beginning of the talk, which of course I found the paper quite fascinating and really excellent, but it's not actually about first love, it's about absence of first love. And what I wanted to think about there was what the first love then is with the analyst, that sometimes, as Winnicott very much emphasizes, there has been an environmental failure of such severity, as in this case, that the patient has never experienced first love until the analysis. And what's so striking about your patient is you then enable her to love outside the analysis, to have, as you say, a reasonably successful marriage, one assumes, two children, etc., which is a remarkable achievement with somebody who's never had love in the first place. And I just wanted to say that, really.
Yeah, she brought a photograph of her with her granddaughter, and obviously was, I mean, very healthy going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the first love, the patient can believe that, but we cannot believe that. As therapists, we cannot believe that they are loving us. It can be the first communication of being understood, of being contained, of all that. But we also have to believe in our own limitations that we're not being loved by everybody, in no way.
And then one in the back. Oh, do the one in the back first, sorry, because the mic's there.
Yes, I just wanted to ask a question about the treatment of people who enact perverse acts, and when is treatment sort of possible and when is it impossible?
Yeah.
And also about, do you think that society is becoming more perverse, really? And I mean, and with, does that mean that that there are more perversions?
Are there more perversions?
No, I hear. I don't want to take it away from David, who seems to be. I don't know. I just want to say, no, the society is not becoming more perverse. Perhaps the people are much more aware of perversions. But I was very, very pleased, because if you remember, it's an automatic response to act, as when David was talking about acts we cannot understand, they challenge our thought process, you know, like when the Bulger case took place, and John Major then Prime Minister said, this is time to understand less and to punish more. It could have been a replication of that, this time with the riots. I wasn't here, but I mean, I know that David Cameron said something like, these are just a bunch of criminals or whatever, or delinquents or whatever. This was not taken well. And then all the newspapers, all the journalists began to go on about reasons for why had happened with the riots. And by the way, it's a great play at the riots at the Tricycle Theater, which is worth your while seeing. And so I think people are not anymore so complacent about, you know, this is true. No, the people want to see more. I think that we have to give credit to people wanting to understand a bit more. Do you agree with that?
I think so. I've got a sneaky suspicion that perversion is getting more expensive than
it's recognized.
Colourful or extraordinary. I mean, the Bulger case is a very interesting case to me, because I work with an art therapist who worked with Thompson and Venables. And I realized when working with her that Thompson and Venables, through this tremendously awful act of communicating in the only way possible in the circumstances they were growing up in, which was pretty awful, really awful, and their own experience of being a child dying psychically away from any help. The terrible thing was, the only way they could express it, they felt, was actually by attacking a child far away from help. You know, you died in this helpless manner. A child, by the way, was being used as a shoplifting decoy by the mother. That's not actually known about very much. I think perversion, there is something about the need to keep to invent things that traumatize society more and more and more. But at some sort of level, I think, this is a game of politics, the market economy, the individual is disappearing fast. So to make one's mark, you know, on the world in some form or other, may actually require extreme circumstances. You know? And I do wonder sometimes that more. I think I've heard everything. You know, thank God. I think I've heard everything now. Something else terrible, even more traumatizing, perverse comes along. You know, and so I do wonder, in a world which actually requires excitement and drama, in the, what should we do about Kevin? Kevin says,
"What should we do? We have to talk. It's therapeutics." We have to talk about Kevin.
Yeah.
Your mistake indicates something else.
You are making a mistake. Kevin says, I'm the sort of people you read about.
Yes.
But I mean, I just.
One way of getting into the mind of an object.
We want to have another of our little arguments. No, but you have made me feel about, or it made me think about something that is interesting about art, because art clearly is very representative of.
Estella, put my.
Art is very representative about what's going on in society. And yesterday I was invited to see that the show Postmodernism at the V&A. And I realized it's from the 70s to the 90s, so it's postmodernism. But then still, it's after that the body is being used. It's in the 90s I start the body, yeah. You know, and art, you know, the body being used, and all sorts of different. We could call perverse actions against the body start taking place in the social life too.
But I think that perhaps indicates, I think it is in a kind of social and political context that body art, you talk to body artists who work with blood and so on, that they will always say that it's a reclamation of control in a society which wants us to be out of control. So your body's your last freedom, so you're not hurting anybody else, you're just using your body as a canvas is a choice. And it's not, and actually, I mean, someone like Franco B, whom I don't know if you know Franco B's work,
yes.
who works with his own, or he worked with his own blood, he doesn't anymore, but he absolutely resists the idea that there's anything, firstly, sadomasochistic or perverse in what he does. I mean, he has a very clear intellectual argument for why he's worked on his own body with his own blood. And I think it's, I don't like using perversion attached to body art. I think it's, whether we like it or not, it represents something different than perversion.
I think that's right, but in terms of the images that circulate in the culture as a whole, it may not take on that moment. I mean, it's true that as an individual, I can say that I'm doing this in order to show up the predatory nature of capitalism, but nonetheless I'm participating in that. And one of the things that's happened, and we see it in the increase of plastic surgery, the commodification of the body, the extreme acts which have become normalized, the compliance of violent behavior within sexuality, which actually seems completely ordinary because it's their own porn sites, the kind of objectification of the body. So I think certain things have shifted, and I don't know how radically they have, because we can only inhabit our own time. I mean, things were, in my researches, things were terrible in the slums of Victorian England, it's quite true. But we've both, in our own age, I think, shrunk the nature of what is normal. In other words, the DSM has colonized a great many of our possibilities and labeled them erotic. I mean, as Foucault said for a long, long time ago, but it's now come true, if you like. But at the same time, we've enabled perversion to be part of our sexuality in a kind of ordinary way. And I think this is something that we need to think about and perhaps also do something about with our children. I don't know quite how, but maybe the analysts can tell us.
I had a terrible job. Had a terrible job once for 6 months. I'm embarrassed being a child of the 60s, working for the British Board of Film Classification. And I thought it'd be a really good job at being paid to watch films, But I wasn't a censor. My job was to say, to advise them whether a film would incite somebody to enact or not. Of course, an impossible question. It depends who's watching it. But what I realised, the films I was watching were pushing the boundary more and more and more. And the film I ended up watching once is about paedophilia. And the actress involved in it, who was a young girl, was actually having real sex on the screen. So I realised at some level, however open-minded I am, I don't want to be so open-minded my brain's fall out. Okay? And you've got to draw the line somewhere. The question is, where do you draw the line? I want to be open-minded. I want to accept that George B., whatever his name was, cutting himself and doing all this blood stuff, isn't a perversion. But there is a line somewhere to be drawn. Okay? Who the hell draws it? To answer your question, you have to do something somewhere along the line. Like the internet at the moment, you can get anything on it. Is that good? I don't believe in censorship. No.
Great but feminist muff march on Harley Street.
Yeah. I tell you though, I mean, what we're talking about pedophiles and all that, that it is really amazing that then the, all the shops for girls, they are filled up with little brassiere or palette. I mean, for children from the age of 5. Yeah. So one way everybody goes against the pedophiles, on the other hand, we are then sexualizing children to offer to them. And then also, we are always looking at the perpetrator. Why don't we look at the children who have been victims? Because some of them are much more vulnerable and much more ready for to take on this. And I think that also then we have to look at parental situations too. But David brought up the case about James Bulger's mother shoplifting. It's very interesting because the judge told us about this in the Glover lecture, and he had all the proofs about how the mother had created a secret signal situation with the child. So if the police were there, the child would make some signals. And then when I tried to use that in writing, I wrote to him asking permission. He said, I'm sorry, I cannot give permission. This cannot be, written down and all that. So we see still. Ah, by the way, I'm talking about this because it's a bit like deception, it's a bit like collusion. And just brought to my mind, the subject for our own next international conference, it is before we knew about Rupert Murdoch and Berlusconi and all that, is in Venice, the end of March, and will be corruption, collusion and deception, attacks on the mind. So if people want to come to Venice and to or to send abstracts on this subject, you can see that it's going on in the air.
There's a question right here. Can you stand up?
Yes. Sort of distract from this interesting conversation about perversion. I just want to ask a question to Bernard about erotic transference. Is erotic transference a inevitable?
Is it
inevitable aspect of the therapeutic process? Is the first thing the question is about. Does it only happen between gender differences? Could it happen between the same sex therapist and the patient?
To take the second part first, my colleague certainly is agreeing it's not gender
specific.
Thank you. This is getting at the time of the day where I'm forgetting words. What was the second?
Is it inevitable?
Yes. Is the erotic transference inevitable? Well, the transference is inevitable. I think that's the major discovery of psychoanalysis that has indeed perhaps spread to other branches, other disciplines, as I understand. One bit of psychoanalysis that's fairly acceptable by people. So the transference is inevitable. Is the erotic transference inevitable? I would think so, because the whole business is all about feelings. It's often about the problems of the first love, which practically all analysts would agree with. Something has gone very wrong somewhere, different levels. So it's going to be replayed with the analyst. And I think the short answer is yes. It probably is. The management is something else, and it getting out of control is something else, which is why I think Freud's discussion is still very useful. And he suggests that there are safeguards, and that the analyst must keep this in mind, even at the level of, well, I'm not so marvellous that my patient falls in love with me. It's not my good looks. It's not my charm. And of course, this is going to happen in counselling. This is going to happen all the way down to psychotherapy, social work, in medicine sometimes, whatever. So, yes, I think the answer to that is the point. Can I just say something about what my colleagues have made me think about with Elizabeth, my patient? And remember, it's almost, I think I would say that my own knowledge of working with perversions is very, very limited. But what did occur to me listening to the discussion is that the nearest I come today in describing Elizabeth was her perverse crossing the road, if you remember, on a green light. And I took it, being deeply in the transference with her, I took it that I should make a protective interpretation. But it now occurs to me, having listened to my colleagues, was that the point? What about if she causes a driver to hit her, and for the rest of that driver's life, they've got that experience of possibly injuring or killing somebody? And that struck me, listening to this, as a sort of perversion. So I've learned something about that, about Elizabeth's behaviour, and I just wanted to say that.
Why shouldn't she cross at a green light?
No, when the light is green, the physical
driver.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, when you know, because you have to wait for the red light to cross the Finchley Road, usually.
Drivers.
And you know, the Finchley Road is.
Somebody was killed some years ago in Finchley Road, going from the Hampstead to the opposite. Yeah.
I mean, the erotic transference is ubiquitous at one level, and I think our patients are asking us all the time, do you know the difference between seduction and taking care of us? No. And it's a very good question, because the analysis is seductive. Come and lie on my couch in a nice cosy room in Hampstead. No. And I'll listen to you absolutely quietly for 50 minutes. No. Well, not quietly. But is it gender-based? No, it isn't. I've probably learned more about my unconscious homophobia from my homosexual patients than I've ever learned from anybody, particularly over the last 20 years with HIV and all the rest of it. You know, I didn't realize just how much I think I had to learn. And so my gay patients have taught me an enormous amount. So much so that the next conference I'm involved in is about homosexuality and psychoanalysis. Okay, and it's in January. And it's going to be an exploration really about how one struggled with the prejudices of the kind of trans women. I think is enormously important. So it's not gender-based at all.
Well, thank you for that. I wonder whether, since we're drawing to the end now, I might ask each of our wonderful speakers just to say one final thought about love, transference and counter-transference, malignant bonds, Don Juan, whatever comes into your mind to give people something to go home with.
Dalai Lama. All I'm going to say is, and this is based on my own experience of working as an analyst throughout my own generations of being young and getting older and things, how hard love is. Love is much, much, much more difficult to sustain than hate and grievance. Okay? Struggle with grievances and hatred and all the rest of it, but to actually sustain love for another human being, the most important thing in the world. So we're all talking about perversions and hatred, etc., etc., but I want to just say how important love is. And without it, we are empty, you know, drums, as the thing in the Bible says. But it's really hard work. Hatred's easy. Love is really hard work, but worth it.
I think it's just too late for me to be kind of give you a word of wisdom. So I just want to say I would recommend that you read Anna Karenina if you're in any way involved. If you're in any way involved in psychotherapy, counselling, social work, whatever, there's a tremendous amount to learn. We often think, you know, that as psychoanalysts we've got so much to teach and we can tell people all about this and this, but in fact literature has got a great deal to teach us. Which is what I was saying Freud says very early on, you know, that the novelists and the poets have really got an enormous amount to teach, particularly about love.
Yeah. Well, and what about Madame Bovary?
Sorry?
What about Madame Bovary?
Exactly. What about her? What about her?
What's that?
Careful
who you advise to
read
Anna Karenina to, because one of my mum's really best friends committed suicide and as a copycat thing, and he read it a few months ago. Okay, I just want to say, perhaps if you want to know about love, just buy your book. That's my recommendation for this audience. Buy
both Anna Karenina and Madame Bovary are my key texts. Yeah. Well, there's Proust too. Comedy.
I suppose I want. I mean, I've learned a lot today, and I'm a lay person in this field. I don't, you know, I'm not a shrink, as I said. But years ago, when I was making my work on the Augustine case, I came here and worked with someone called Carolyn Garland.
Oh, yes.
And she gave me a fantastic quote we put in the program, which I'm just really struck by your compassion as professionals, the love that your job is about. And she, as I'm slightly paraphrasing, but she said, understanding is a form of love. And I think that that's a very beautiful thing I'm taking away from today, is that, you know, whether we're talking about perverse love or all these, you know, terrible cases, whether you feel yourselves objects of love or hate as therapists, I think your work is a work of love. And I think so is art, by the way, and they're very close and professional.
Thank you for that, and thank you to all of you. Can I just say, since we're recommending books, that I do recommend, many of you probably have, but it's worth going back to Freud, too. Freud is rather wonderful in Radiva, which is all about love and how therapy is counter version of this, or a mirroring version of that. His essays on the ups and downs and the ins and outs of relations between the sexes, objects, orientations, all of that. It's still, some of it is still true. Certainly it still continues to speak. So as the non-analyst in the room, I'd like to say that and to thank you all for being here and to give a huge hand to our audience.